Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 221. How are you guys? This is the first intro, the first time I'm speaking to you as a 37-year-old. I think you'll agree I sound a lot wiser. And that's about it. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for all the love of the last week or so. I got a lot of lovely birthday messages. Last week's podcast with Chili Gonzalez, a lot of you agreed, is the best Distraction Pieces Podcast episode I've ever done. I absolutely adored it. He's just a great dude. And then there was the bonus birthday party episode, which if you missed, I snuck out on Friday. I had a little birthday party with all my celebrity friends and recorded a podcast. But I also released, as you will hear on that, and you may have seen online, my birthday. I do a birthday release every year, and this year it was another collaboration with the artist Riker, and we made a Screwiest Pip He-Man toy, essentially. We changed it from Masters of the Universe to Master of the Spoken Verse, and it's quite special. But they sold out within an hour or so, so thank you all for supporting there. What I am here to do now, though, is have a wonderful conversation with Mr. Tony Law, who was kind enough to come to my house, and genuinely such a beautiful and engaging and insightful conversation. Really heartbreaking at points. I'll reflect on one point at the end because it really was striking to me, but I don't want to give any spoilers. Before we get there, I'll do two things. I'm going to give you all some Edinburgh Fringe recommendations, including Tony, and I'm going to tell you that this is brought to you by speechdevelopmentrecords.com, where you can go and buy the sunglasses. Are just about in stock still. Every time I order some, they seem to sell out in absolutely no time. We've got probably the most offensive bit of merch I've ever done, the Make Pip Rap Again hats in the style of, obviously, Make America Great Again. So that's completely unacceptable. But yeah, I really appreciate everyone who went there as well. I had a lot of sales of all sorts of stuff on my birthday, because I always kind of say, or birthday aside, if you're a fan of the podcast and you've been listening to them for free for a long time, I don't want any donations. That's fine. It's not that. It's free for you. But if you did want to contribute at all, then the best way is to go and buy some merch, because then you get something, I get something. It's win-win. Anyway, on with my Fringe recommendations. First of all, of course, Tony Law. You'll hear from this podcast. It's a really special show from. It's called A Lost Show. It's at Monkey Barrel 1, and it's at 3 p.m. every day, the 5th till the 12th, and then the 14th till the 26th. So check that out. Other ones I would recommend. Brett Goldstein is obviously his films to be buried with podcast is quite possibly going to become bigger than Distraction Pieces, which is quite frustrating because it's part of the network and I'm the boss and I like being the big dog, but it's gone crazy. Everyone is being raved about in The Guardian, in all sorts of magazines and online places. So, but Brett has got an amazing show called What Is Love? Baby Don't Hurt Me. And it's at the Pleasance Courtyard every night at 7 p.m. Honestly, I can't recommend Brett enough. He's obviously he's a mate now, but the first times I met him or saw him was just being blown away by his comedy and the way he crafts a show. Speaking of crafted shows, Brian Gittins, Don't Feed the Monkey Man. I'm smiling because Brian's shows are a beautiful mess of chaos. But again, another guy who I only met because I was a fan and I had seen his show a few times, and then I forced him to come on tour with me on my spoken word tour. So yeah, Brian Gittins, Don't Feed the Monkey Man at Heroes at Boteco at 6:40. So yeah, go and check that out. Make note of these. I'm putting these in the intro so you can come back to them easy and not have to hunt through the whole of the podcast. And last but obviously not least is Rob Alton. Any of you who've listened for a long time will know I rave about Rob Alton every year. He's always my fringe highlight. And I'm sure it won't change this year. Rob Alton has a new show called The Talk Show. He's previously done The Hair Show, The Sky Show, just loads of The Yellow Show, just amazing shows. He's on it at 6:10 p.m. at Just the Tonic Caves. So yeah, go and check out Mr. Rob Alton. You will love that. And that's my that's my recommendation. So on with the episode. This is episode 221 of the Distraction Pieces podcast, and my guest today is the amazing Mr. Tony Law. I'll start rolling now in the podcast tradition. I'm joined by Tony Law. How are you today, sir?
Yeah, really good, thank you. And I just wanted to say thanks for having me on.
No problem.
I chased you down, didn't I?
You did chase me down.
I got on the
wonderfully.
I got on the old Twitter.
On the old Twitter,
and because I was listening to you, and Adam Buxton came up, and I was going to be seeing Adam the next week. And I don't know, you know what it's like when you're driving?
Yeah.
I just thought, you know what, I'm going to take things into my own hands. And then I pulled over and I tweeted you right away, can I come on your show? And you, to my surprise, went, yeah.
I loved it. Oh, I've followed each other for a while on social media. And it's genuine. It's like whenever I get people to request guests, I'm always like, if you can, tag them in some way. Because they assume I've got some big contact book. Or
right.
It's like, I don't. If there's a way of going, I'd like to hear you on here, and then I can respond and say, I'd like that too, then that introduction is made.
So
it helps when these things happen.
Oh, no, that's, it's been good for me, because I'm trying to, you know, I'm sort of relaunching in a way. I'm trying to salvage a career now.
Yeah.
So I need to, and I'm going back up to Edinburgh Fringe, so I'm trying to do whatever I can to,
as
get,
much as you can to
get a nice crowd in. Because I'm sort of pushing a rock. I've been pushing a rock up the hill, because I'm not new.
Yeah.
I'm not purposely a cult comedian.
Yeah.
That's because of all the bridges I burnt due to my alcoholism and my drug problems. And so I'm not new. I've still got a foreign accent, and I'm actually getting pretty old now too. So there's nothing to really sell other than the fact that I'm 3 years sober. I'm actually really good at it now.
Yeah.
Which seems a shame, because I had like a modicum of success before I really got out of control. And then when I got out, so basically, if it wasn't for the kindness of people, mainly performers, and that like supporting me, because they could see, they got a chance to see me say like 4 or 5 times, so they could see 2 where I was just a mess, and then 3 when I was really good. So they, you know, but
right,
just,
yeah.
And, so there's all these bridges I've burned.
And again, it's a tough one, because your style of comedy, I've caught you once or twice, but a while back, and it's all quite surreal, and it's quite scattergun, and a lot of it can be quite a lot of audience participation and things like that. So the problem with that is you can kid yourself that because there's a lot of improvisation, that you can just turn up and do it. As weird as that sounds, you can kid yourself that that's all you need. Whereas even if it's improvised, you need to be in the right headspace, right?
So, and it all hangs off of you know, tightly scripted things that that have to happen. And but I think what I've learned in the last year of, like, so I've sort of got used to sobriety in the last years. I've learned that that I was probably when making things deliberately obtuse. I don't know if that's the right word,
but I
sort of, because then that would save me from failing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then only the people who really got it would get it. But actually, now that I'm sort of seeing the world clearly, I quite like, I want everyone to just have a laugh and just be plain funny.
It's such a weird one in music and in comedy and everywhere. There will be an element, even from a fan's perspective, of wanting things to be small and underground. But I remember years ago, I was talking to Saul Williams, who's one of my favourite musicians and spoken word artists and rappers, and he blew me away. I kind of looked up to him, and I was one of those kids who was like, yeah, I'm all about being underground. I'm the underground, I'm this and that. And he kind of just said, look, I've no loyalty to the underground. If you're proud of what you're doing, you want as many people to hear as possible. He's like, I exist on the underground, and I'm grateful for the underground, but I want it to be out there as much as possible.
Well, you know what did it for me was because I was sort of you know, like near the end, burning a few bridges. Like I actually was telling myself all these things when I was really out of control. Like, oh, I'm not getting back on TV right now because I've got a Canadian accent, or I'm not flavor of the month because blah, blah, blah. And then, but now from a clear looking back, I'm just going, no, it's because you were unreliable. Like, you know, And yeah. And so there's going to be a time lag where people go, oh, yeah, Izzy, oh, he's sober 3 years. But, you know, so you've got to convince people. And also there's so many people who have invested in you that you need to sort of repay. Like Noel Fielding's always been a good supporter, and Adam Bucks and all those guys. But I think the doing a tour show, because that's my favorite thing in the world is to tour. I remember thinking to myself, these are people, there's like a family. I get a lot of families now. Whereas the young the parents bring the kids that are becoming young adults. And I was just looking across this really varied group of people and thought, they don't think that I'm underground or niche. They just think I'm what they like to laugh at.
I thought,
oh shit, so maybe there's loads more of them out there.
Yeah.
So I just need to find them.
Do you think the kind of perception of the more left field and surreal style of comedy, do you think that led or supported a life of addiction? Because I mean, let's talk about that.
Because
again, you watch someone like, I remember seeing Noel Fielding for the first time just before Bush blew up, and I'm not cool and credible. He was on a lineup with Coogan and all these amazing people. I'd never heard of him, and he just blew me away because he was so crazy and all over the place. But then if you look back now, he must have either had a good business head on him or had good people around him, because the Bush stuff was incredibly organised.
Yeah.
Buzzcocks. He's doing Bake Off now, for God's sake. That's the scattergun crazy. So it was kind of having that control to turn on that crazy insanity, go all over the place surrealness. But if you don't know what's going on behind the scenes, you might just think, well, I just need to live that as a life, which might not turn into a sustainable career.
Yeah, I think, mine was when I, like as a farm boy in Canada, when I first laid eyes on Monty Python when I was 15, that just was, it was like a religious experience, and it was emotional for me. Like I remember weeping, I was laughing and weeping as a 15-year-old going, I can't believe there's something like this that exists. And so I've always been sort of pursuing that kind of crazy thing. And then, but I didn't really know how to go about it, you know, like a lot of farm kids or people from the middle of nowhere do. So then I end up on the stand-up circuit, and I'm failing at stand-up because I'm not, you know, I'm doing it wrong. Like really brilliant observational comedians, when you're on a bill with them, you look shit.
Yeah,
but there's something inside of you that goes, no, I think I'm good.
Yeah.
And you keep going. And then you grab onto a Noel Fielding or you grab onto a Ross Noble and go, oh, they're doing it somehow.
Completely.
And I think that the alcoholism and all that, I think that comes anyway with whatever low self-esteem you have. And
For me,
it actually blew up the most when I was starting to get, and it looked like I was heading for success.
Yeah.
And there was like an implosion, like I didn't feel like I deserved it, like a fraud sort of thing. This is only looking back.
And
this is only after, like, you know, reading a bit about therapy.
that
it was like an implosion, like I thought, you know, like a fear of success, which sounds pretty wanky, but I think that's what it might
have natural.
Been.
It's scary because you kind of strive towards success because you're like, I want to do that. I want to be part of this. It's, again, you see a Noel Fielding or a Ross Noble or whoever and go, that's what I want to do. But there's not, it's comedy and music and all that kind of thing are the areas that they don't touch upon at all in school or anything like that. So you never have any kind of formal education on how it all works. So you strive for that.
Yeah.
And then when it starts to happen, it naturally can feel overwhelming. Or you can feel, actually, I don't know what I'm doing. And I don't want anyone to know I don't know what I'm doing. So I'm going to kind of self-sabotage.
Well, all my heroes, like, because I wasn't one of those people who just like comedy. My heroes are mainly music as a teen. Yeah. That's why I kind of moved to, it was exactly why I moved to England. When I was a teenager on the tractor and stuff, all the music I listened to is English. And
yeah.
So I just dreamt of going, I'm going to go to England, man. I'll show everybody and I'm going to be in a band. I think I might have been picking the wrong heroes. So I was, you know, I was like Keith Moon, of course. And all the, and actually, as you get older and sober, you think, no, Roger Daltrey's a really good example of how to stay sober, be a family man, keep your shit together and drive that train. That's the guy you want to...
You should focus on.
Yeah. Keith Moon's dead.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Looking at the ones who held it together.
Yeah.
So what was it like growing up in Canada on a farm, kind of secluded from all the culture that you're I'd imagine, dying to immerse yourself in.
Yeah, just a cultural wasteland, of course. Probably idyllic. Probably most people just think I'm mad. Yeah. I just always wanting something else, something else. It's great if that's the sort of way you worked and you want to be a farmer or work in the, you know. I was pretty shit at everything. And so I needed to, so it's just music and, you know, and everything else has just been this curiosity and learning and, you know, like even to the point where I sometimes try and look at my shows, solo shows, as being like kind of a painting. So I want like people, like so many people do really good storytelling and then other people do really good tight routines. I try and do something that's where it's like a feeling you have at the end of it.
Yeah.
And then people can discuss what it meant because I know what I mean. And so like this new show, I have a thread throughout it that it's kind of about rebirth, and it's a little bit about being overwhelmed and about light bulbs coming on. Yeah. So there's loads of imagery in it, and I'm just hoping that at the end of it, people go, "Oh yeah, I think it might have been about that. It might have been." But overall, you want people to walk out and go, "Fuck, that was funny," and I feel really good about stuff now. Yeah. That's the feeling, rather than I want to make it really hard for journalists to write about it.
That's great, because it's something that's escaped from so many art forms now. I think we forget with TV and film and comedy that art isn't always about having it all explained and tied up in a nice bow at the end. If you go to a gallery, you look at a painting and you like it, you might not understand it yet, but you're like, I like that. And then over time, you might understand it more. You might read a bit about how it was created or the time or what the meanings were. That can all come later. But art, I'm not saying all art should be confusing and obscure, but that's comedy is art and film is art. And all of those things now, we seem to have gone,
well,
not to pick a cliche, but here's the story of my relationship with my father. And this is my Edinburgh Fringe show. Yeah. There's a beginning, a middle and an end. It makes sense. So. Yeah. There is something in that.
There's room for it, for sure. Yeah,
completely, completely.
And then other people might be getting out a similar story in a different way.
Yeah.
But it's like when I went to, you know, because I love the fact that I'm a farm boy. Like, I like my working class roots.
Yeah.
But I also love that I'm slowly attempting to turn into a snob.
Yeah.
And I love going, and I went to the Picasso exhibition. Yeah. I just love being me in there. That's the beauty of sobriety. It's going, really enjoying being this guy, looking at this, trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
And what I really loved is, you know, then he shows something where he can paint really well, like in a traditional portrait style.
Yeah.
And you look at that and you go, oh, so that's the key. He can do that.
Yeah.
But he chooses to do this bonkers
completely stuff. And again, it's the approach of looking at art. I'm a fan of a lot of art that's hyper real and things like that. I've got a painting behind you now by a guy called Joe Simpson, which it looks like a photo, but it wasn't until I started to go to art exhibitions with my brother. He was kind of saying the art that he likes is the opposite of that, because we now have photography.
Yeah.
So photography can capture realism. We've got that. I don't need painting to be a version of photography. I want painting to be painting. I want painting to capture what a photo can't. And that's where Picasso and things like that come in. You couldn't take a picture of that because it's not something that exists in the real world. And it's also where people like yourself and Noel Fielden and Ross Noble started to appeal to me in comedy, because it wasn't the comedy I'd grown up on was quite observational at points. Here's stuff that you can relate to. The first time I saw Noel Fielden, I was like, I can't relate to that at all. He's talking about hunting a unicorn in the desert, and it turns out to be a horse that's in an ice cream jacket.
He's further out there than me.
and things like that, though. And that suddenly became the appeal. It's like, right, that comedy isn't relatable, but that's what appeals about it.
I think what I try and do sometimes is to make something be someone to feel really familiar about something and really laugh at it. And at the end of it going, how is that possible that I feel I feel like I can relate to it?
Yeah.
And I think the danger could be like, and I'm so lucky that I've had like I've built up a small fan base that sort of stuck with me. And, you know, like instead of deliberate, like I was doing tours to the fan base, or if I knew Adam Buxton was in, for example, I would deliberately do, if the joke came to two different branches, I would go the one less traveled to entertain just Adam Buxton, who's in. And then I was starting to do that to my audience too. And now I'm actually trying to choose a middle branch that isn't there yet. But I can't remember what I was talking about. But it's all trying to be funnier to more people. Like it, and also like I can do observational stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't think that I can do it as good as Michael McIntyre can do it.
Yeah, sure.
And I think he's great at it. But I think lots of people in their groups of friends can do it as well. So I think it's maybe trying to be that friend to people that is that little extra bit.
Yeah, and it's finding the balance there. It's something I talked about with Kate Nash on a recent podcast, was the fact that it's a really important breakthrough when you realise that you're there to entertain the crowd. And as long as you've created your art purely, on the night, it should be about entertaining the crowd. It shouldn't be about going, oh, look at how clever I am, or look at how obscure I am. So wanting to find that balance in between playing to the niche comedians, being the comedian's favourite comedian, and playing to a broader one is a positive thing. It's not saying that I'm going to go all the way over and try and do what Michael McIntyre did.
Yeah.
That does. Again, he's someone that gets a lot of hate from alternative crowds, but he's really good at what he does.
Yeah, he's got funny bones.
Yeah.
My favorite of was like how Sean Locke made the move, and I can remember that exactly when because I knew some of the guys that were working with him at the time. Yeah. It was like, he just said, you know what, I'm sick of being the guy who gets laughs from the people at the back of the room.
Yeah.
And from what I observed, his material was exactly the same. He just started wearing a suit.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't seem any different
as
to me.
Simple as that, yeah.
And I think it was an attitude shift.
Yeah.
And he sort of took his ambition out of the gutter, kind of.
Yeah.
And that was what it was. And so I'm trying to make that same sort of change, not to become like as big as Sean Locke, but I need to get my audience big enough to sustain the thing that I love doing more in the world than anything, which is getting in a car, putting on some podcasts, driving 4 hours while talking to myself, just getting all this stuff out, arriving at a place with a sound technician that I know from before, catching up with him, setting it up, putting up, and then him going, oh, I can't believe you're doing that this year. Really? You need a giant beach ball? You know? And then doing a show, entertaining these people like friends, talking to them afterwards, and then driving home on cloud nine.
Yeah.
That's my dream.
Yeah.
And so I can do that, but only for smaller portions of the year. So I just need to make that. Now that I know what the dream is, I'm chasing it.
it's getting that focus on it. So what was the dream when you made a huge move of moving from a farm in Canada to London? How old were you at that point?
19.
Yeah. That's pretty much as early as you could have realistically made the move, right?
I would have gone earlier, and I think the alarm bell should have been ringing then, but I lost my license to drunk driving. And I was working on an oil field. I was doing all those sorts of jobs, and I'm just hating it because I was always getting, I was always just a moron at it.
Yeah.
But just saving money. I no idea, like no focus, no idea, no education, no just knew I'm going to England.
Yeah,
gonna go over there, and it was like I sort of talk about it in my new set, but I was trying to sum up what the attitude is of the English that I really loved.
Yeah,
growing up, and the only way I can sum it up is fuck off.
That's it.
And that I just wanted, I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
But there was something about this attitude that was like people going proud of who they are.
Yeah.
This conformity thing. I really, really wasn't getting that where I was from.
Yeah.
Fuck off, mate.
Yeah.
And I wanted a bit of that.
It's the British almost illogical and against all wills pride of who they are.
Yeah.
Even if we're in a bad place. It's like, we're fucking British, though. Britain's a mess at the moment. Yeah, but it's our mess. Yeah.
Well, there's something about that. There's something about taking these two stones and smashing them together, and then a new bit flies off.
Yeah,
you know, you've wrecked the rocks.
Yeah,
but
you've got
a nice new rock.
Yeah.
So you never know. Like, there's bad to that too. But so that was basically it. I had no plan, and then I had this parallel thing running in parallel. I was really into history.
Yeah.
And I needed to get closer to the history I was into Anglo-Saxons and Vikings. You know, all that classic.
Yeah.
And I got a job working as a tour operator around Europe.
Oh, wow.
Which in those days you could lie about your education.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And my degree was still in the post.
Particularly if you've come from a long way away it's easy to.
And they never worked out that I was far too young to have graduated from the University of Calgary.
Brilliant.
But I looked old.
Yeah.
From the drinking.
Yeah.
And but I was very good with the blag, so I went around Europe on coaches standing up at the front.
Yeah.
Just, you know, knowing mostly what I was talking about, but also riffing a lot.
Yeah.
They gave me the Korean tours.
Amazing.
And so there was always a bit of thinking time, because by time the translator had finished saying what I just said, I've already thought of my next line.
Yeah, yeah.
And they used to ask so many questions, and I, painfully polite, like I just wouldn't do anything, like I would do anything they wanted. You know, but they would ask questions about everything, like just a random fountain on the edge of a random old town, and I would just have to riff it. And I'd be like, and I'd just been reading about Carlos the Jackal, so I said that was called Miss Me Fountains. And Bing Long, that's pretty racist, but you get the idea. Miss Me Fountain, Charles de Gaulle.
Yeah.
And then, so that was good.
Amazing.
Riffing. And they used to say on the Korean tours, like, to instill discipline in your coach trips, that you leave, if not everyone is back to your coach, you leave anyway. They have to find their way to the next. I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
So we were hours late for things turning up, like really late at night.
Oh, really?
I would just wait for the guys to get back. Pretty soon they realized that they could all be late. So if I said 1 o'clock, they would all just come whenever.
That stroll back.
Yeah. But they seemed to have a good time. That was a long time ago.
I love that. So did that kind of work as early kind of prep for stand up, because it's getting up in front of a crowd, it's thinking on your feet, it's having a set routine. And again, on the tours I've done of that kind of thing, the best ones are when the guide is having a bit of a laugh, giving a bit of material in there and things like that. And you hear of a lot of comedians who start off on that as that kind of route of going, well, I'm making people laugh, it's tourists, so it's not necessarily your refined comedy audience, but it's that experience and well, setting that ground.
I think it was like a series of one thing leads to the next. I think I have memories of it starting out, or how great it felt inside of the bottom of my stomach when I could make my parents laugh.
Yeah.
And then my sister was a great laugher.
Yeah.
And having her just laughing at me my whole life growing up just encouraged me. And it just replaces all your self-esteem. If you've got issues with whatever issues you got, if you're getting laughs from friends or whatever.
Yeah.
But then, you know, that can be the only thing you are.
Yeah.
And so you churn through groups of friends because they realize that this guy's here to just do laughs.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you combine that with the drinking.
Yeah.
And, you end up with a group of friends in Austria when you live there for a year.
Yeah.
And for about 9 months, they think you're the greatest guy ever. And then at the end of the 9 months, they think, this is all this guy is.
Yeah.
And you go, take your booze.
Yeah.
Move on.
Yeah.
Take your booze and move on.
It's a mad one then to be in kind of the traveling, you know, local entertainment as such. The exciting drunk guy that comes and lights us all up.
And cries himself to sleep.
But that's it. But those things always do have a limit. Again, it's that thing of you look at that character in a movie, and, you know, that's the coolest guy in the world.
Yeah.
But you're not seeing 6 months down the line where he's still pouring a beer on his head or pouring a beer over his mates as a joke, and they're getting to the point of, it's not funny anymore, man. Can you
just
relax?
always riffing. I've never done I've never done banter.
Yeah.
So everything's been I've always enjoyed surprising people with surrealism. I tell you what, but sobriety, that first year of sobriety, I thought, this is terrible. I don't know why people are banging on about it. But actually, last 2 years, I've realized it's way easier, like, going on stage now. I can't believe all the extra tools you have at your disposal. You can be so much more loose. It's the worlds you can paint are just way, way better. Sometimes people get that wrong idea. They go, no, how did you find it when you stopped drinking? Did you find you lost anything? And then, well, no, because drinking lost me any opportunities I ever had. So there was, it's the difference between being like funny 40% of the time and being funny all the time.
Yeah, yeah. It's a fascinating one, because do you think that the drinking, I guess if you already had it in Canada, I was going to say, drinking was in way a crutch for being in a scary situation. You've travelled halfway around the world and you're on your own and you're trying to make new friends. I know that when I gigged doing music for about 10 years, and for at least seven of them, I'd drink every gig and have a good old drink. And then I started a tour after about, yeah, around the seventh year, and I'd just come off of having tonsillitis, so I couldn't drink. And I did those gigs, and I suddenly like, oh, wait, I'm much better yeah. sober. I was drinking originally to give me the confidence,
yep,
to get me up there and get me going. But I'd got to the point, I've been doing this 7 years now, I know how to do it, and I'm quite good at it, so I don't need that drink to get me over the finishing line anymore. So I then didn't drink for any shows after that, because I realised, yeah, I'm that much more lucid, I'm that much more in control, whereas before I was autopiloting through, and it was working and good because I'm so used to it, but having that slight more awareness was a massive boost.
Oh, yeah, no, completely. And you don't, I didn't see it at the time. I remember I caught myself on an old Have I Got News for You.
Yeah.
And my memory of it was that was like this weird, crazy pride. Like, I'd been up 5 days. I didn't say this to anyone. This is in my head. I'd been up 5 days, you know, because I hated what was doing and going through. Anyway, but my thing at the end of it was at least I was still doing good gigs, and at least I was
pulling it out.
But I saw myself on it, and I thought, okay, in one way, it was heroic, considering what I put myself through to get there.
Yeah.
But then in another way, I was looking at it, I was going, nah, there's so much potential to have been way funnier.
Right.
I've really been special.
Yeah.
But instead, I was just a kind of a rogue guy on the end of the panel.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit funny, pretty funny.
Yeah, yeah.
But nowhere, you know, you just see all the wasted chances. That's the kind of difference now, I guess.
Yeah. To have that high for awareness of that's what I could have done in that situation. So when did you find yourself, like, you came over and you're all over? You're
travel. Right.
First, and then you settled in London in the end, or was it?
Yeah, yeah. Then I, because I was just using these travel companies as living in Europe a little bit.
Mm.
Yeah, then I settled down when I started working in bars in the 90s. Well, I say settled. I mean, I discovered dance music and what everyone from English people from the 90s were doing.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
was new to me.
Yeah.
I'd never even... So I did that for a little while, too long, and then started comedy, and so I think properly settled be very late 90s.
Yeah, and how was it kind of entering into the comedy scene at that point? You would have had your kind of Newman and Baddiel and that kind of thing blowing up stand-up in the UK.
I didn't notice any of that.
Yeah,
I was very untapped into any media and like... I remember I struggled to get a TV for a while. I think what pushed me back into comedy was watching The Day to Day on VHS tape and going, oh yeah, comedy's really, really good.
Yeah.
Then I met Stuart Lee and he quite liked me, and that was encouraging.
Yeah.
And he sort of taught me about work ethic and stuff, like, because I had no idea, like I think people who've been to college and university and stuff, the real advantage for them is they know how to sit down with a notepad or a typewriter and they know how to apply it.
Yeah.
Whereas all I was doing was sort of like turning up and having a riff.
Completely. And you realize like people at points will say, this course at university is pointless to do because it does. But the fact is, and I dropped out of university, so I'm not an example of this, but anything at university is showing that you can start something hard and complete it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the key thing as a life skill, because it's not... start something hard that takes a month and complete. It starts something that takes 3 years at least to get from beginning to end and come out the other end of it. And that's a huge thing for work effort. Well, and Stuart Lee's a prime example of someone who's got the best work effort. The way he'll structure his shows and he'll do... I've seen him do a month or two of work in progress, just going through and really beating out this show until it's ready to then...
Well, I fumbled around through the 2000s, like doing club gigs and then dabbling with Edinburgh Fringe when I discovered that. And, you know, it's kind of pretty much failing, but bimbling it on, you know, having to pay the rent. So doing the Jongleurs gigs, but always being put on in the middle. And
then I'd
been friends with Stuart for a long time. And I asked him, can I just open for you on a tour?
Yeah.
I need a break. You know, I just need some consistent gigs to nice people. And I went on tour with him, and that was a real, real great change. Because then I watched, we had this very specific pattern every day. We'd go see something historical, then we'd go eat lunch, and then I'd read some books, and then amazing. I'd write. And then so ever since then, that's kind of what I try and do, is look really at something, system. Read something, do something.
And how was that to, because again, people who have not been to both might not realise, but doing things like a jungler's gig and then doing a support on a Stuart Lee tour, it's a world of difference because the audience is completely different. And Stuart used to have a bit where he'd do a joke and then explain that if you're not laughing, you're wrong, because he knows comedy better than you because he's been to, and it is that kind of thing. If you're going to a Stuart Lee gig, you're a fan of comedy, so you are going to have that bit more of an educated ear. If you go into a Junglers, which again are great, it's generally people are like, let's have a few beers and watch something funny. You're not there for anyone in particular. You might not have a favourite comedian. Do you know what I mean? Things like, it's like, oh, I love a bit of comedy.
Yeah.
But it's not refined enough to be, I like this style or this style. Yeah. Whereas, again, a tour show, you're a fan of comedy. You've got favourite comedians. You go out for specific people rather than, it's Friday, should we go and watch some comedy and see what's on? It's like, it's weird because you wouldn't particularly do that with, well, I guess people do with music. Again, I guess that's the equivalent then. Well, it's the equivalent of going to see a band who are on tour because you're into them and going, should we go down to the pub? There's some live music on.
And I think, you know, and then...
That's the crowds.
Yeah, because when you're doing that, what a sensible act would do is hone his set for that.
Yeah.
And make sure he could maximize the results he was getting in those places. And what the only thing I did to try and change it around, because I knew I had to do them, was I wasn't able to do that. Because if I tried to do that, I was just a half-assed hack who didn't. I was just someone who didn't believe in what he's doing.
Yeah.
So I thought I would just do more of me and louder,
right?
And then and do a little bit of bringing people along, but try and give them way more signals at the beginning that it's okay to laugh at this. It's meant to be like this.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's meant to be. But what I found from that is it didn't necessarily mean that those types of gigs went any better for me.
Right.
But I did bring along with me some fans, because I get to chat with them after the shows.
Yeah. Like,
and they usually say, oh, I'm only the second time I've seen you. I came to you through this. Or And where did you come to find out about me? And I saw you at, Just the Tonic.
Yeah.
He goes, yeah, everybody hated you, but I thought you were awesome. And I thought, oh, that's great. So I'm sort of going around picking them up.
And finding them. And again, I mean, that's a real realization as well, and an important one for anyone who's starting out, just remembering that every gig's important, regardless of what the crowd is or how big the crowd is. You could get that one person who then sticks with you. And it might not even be obvious on the night. I've had gigs before that I thought have gone awful because the crowd are so quiet. And then afterwards, I've had the most messages from people saying, that's one of the best gigs I've seen. And in my mind, I'm like, well why didn't you show that? I literally got nothing. But again, it's what counts. It's how different people react. I'm not someone who goes to a gig and jumps about anymore.
No.
I'm someone who stands back and enjoys it. Yeah. So for me to get annoyed that I didn't get that feeling, it's like they were all acting like I act at a gig.
Yeah.
They were going, this is really good.
And it all depends on the mood too, doesn't it? Like sometimes I'm in a real laughing mood and I just really go for it. Wah, wah, wah. Yeah, sometimes I can spot when someone's just awesome and I really love them, but I'm just not in the laughing mood.
But you've got that appreciation. Yeah. You've got that, wow, this guy's killing it.
Yeah, so I think like then the more people you get to come to your shows, it's just all catch 22, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all Sod's Law or whatever it is. Yeah, the more people you get and the more times you've been on TV, the more times when you've had a run on TV, people give you 5 minutes more.
Yeah.
And it becomes easier. It's when you haven't been on TV or something like that, it's harder to bring the new ones along. But then the ones that are already fans, there's a deeper level.
Yeah.
Something. Yeah.
Yeah.
I still haven't developed a vocabulary for all of it.
So how was it when you started to get that fan base and started to get panel show slots and stuff like that? Was that motivating, scary, intimidating?
No, I loved it. Like I was over the moon. I really enjoyed doing that.
Yeah.
And at first my persona on stage and my persona in a panel show was the same.
Right.
There was, you know, and I loved it. The idea that you could go get paid some money to sit in front of a whole bunch of people bringing you coffees or whatever drink you wanted, and looking after you, and a car takes you there. It was like I was in heaven.
Yeah.
Big lights on you. So I really thrived in those. But unfortunately, that sort of coincided with the whole everything. The booze and that all just started to peak. In some ways, cocaine brought forward the alcoholism.
Right.
Because it probably could have lumbered on for another 20 years. Yeah, but instead, it just brought it forward and intensified it. So it had to stop.
Yeah.
So I was doing it secretly. And what I've learned, and I'm no therapist, but what I've learned is that cocaine will not work if you're looking for a way to sober up.
Yeah. Yeah.
It actually has a detrimental effect. And I was doing it secretly, you know, like just like not in a party way.
Yeah.
I used to be like anti-party guy, but I was doing it all on my own to kind of level the booze out.
Yeah. And that's when it's, you know, undeniably a problem is, is when I've known people who are doing it when they get home rather than on their way out. It's like, that's where you've got it backwards. That's where it's like, right, this is addiction now. I'm not a cocaine guy, but I can kind of understand it if you're like, yeah, we're going out and doing this. I want to feel a certain way. Then I can kind of go, all right, well, it's not for me, but you're a grown up. It's your choice.
Yeah.
You do that. But the bit where, again, all that logic goes out the window is when you are doing it secretly, or you are doing it at the end of the night, or you are doing it to balance out.
If you're doing a thing that you don't like you don't like the idea of doing it, like it doesn't suit you, just say, oh, I don't like that lifestyle. I don't want to be someone who does that.
Yeah.
But I need to do that.
Yeah.
That's a bad problem, scene.
Right? Yeah.
But anyway, that's just a terrific relief.
Yeah.
You know, that's all. So in that way, if you can even say that, it helped.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was the moment you kind of realized that the alcohol was a problem? So kind of the cocaine sped up or brought it all to a head.
Yeah.
So what was that kind of point? Like, was there a period where you were like, this all works great. This balances out. I'm drinking.
There was a window.
Coke levels it out. I've found my perfect balance.
When I was getting too sloppy drunk, and then I sort of, there was like a, I discovered, or not discovered, I thought, oh yeah, I could try that.
Yeah.
When I was getting too sloppy. Yeah, there was a window of 6 months where I was I felt like I was just bulletproof.
Yeah.
And everything was working fine.
Because again,
it might not have been, but it felt like it was.
But if you've got to the point where you feel, as you said, the drinking is making you too sloppy, if you find something that just takes the edge off that and sharpens you up a bit, then as you said, it kind of allows you to keep going at that stage.
Did you see that film with Denzel Washington, who's a pilot?
Yes.
That was the best description I've seen of it. It's like going, oh, yeah, I can see it. But it's brilliant.
Yeah.
And I'm not a fan of that sort of thing. But, there was a window where I thought, oh, yeah, you've nailed it. And then, of course, your soul falls out the bottom of your car.
Yeah.
In hindsight, you can go, God, what a terrible bunch of decisions.
Yeah.
And the whole time would have been much better if I just didn't bother with any of it.
Yeah.
But it was too ingrained in me, the drinking and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've had moments where I thought I shouldn't drink since I was 16.
Yeah.
You know, every couple of years or sometimes every few months going, oh, and then, you know, you find a way to get past that and bury it.
And do you feel there was a pressure of it had become part of how people know you or who people know you to be, that you are kind of a big drinker and the party guy, and then you've got that pressure to be that guy, even if you're thinking, I kind of want to stop this, but
maybe
I've got my audience as such, even if it is just friends, other comedians or that kind of thing, it's like, oh no, we need to be...
Not really. I was kind of lucky enough that being in an industry where being sober was kind of the de rigueur.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like a David O'Doherty and all that lot, and Daniel Kitson and all those guys were like, sober is cool.
Yeah.
And those are my friends.
Yeah.
And this is the worst. I remember not being able. So I remember being in Melbourne, and every time I traveled, the drinking was really way worse. So like Australia, nothing but bad times out there due to my drinking. As soon as you get traveling, I don't know what it is. But I remember like seeing those guys, a whole group of friends hanging out. And I remember being sort of ashamed that I was so heavily drinking that I would take corners to avoid them. So I didn't want them to see me drunk.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but you find out other drunks, you know, or people that aren't drunks but are just having a lot of drinks at that time because you're in Melbourne. I was hanging out with Sean Locke and Stuart Lee and Mike Wilmot.
Yeah.
Those, the older guys, because they were having a few beers, but they were having a few beers and then stopping.
Yeah.
And I was just finding anybody was having beers. But yeah, I remember that
from group to group of having their few beers and
I remember very specifically not being able to look David O'Doherty in the eye.
Right.
And nothing, you know, he must have thought I was just such a rude person, but it was mainly I felt ashamed of myself.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a long self-loathing period, isn't it? But I don't want to. I didn't come on to do the Tony Law whining hour.
But that's it. So how was it when you realised that it was an issue, and what kind of prompted you to call it a day, to get clean?
It was just, it'd been constantly bugging me. And that's, of course, that's why people continue to drink, isn't it? Because you can't stand the fact that so you drink and then you put away the idea of stopping.
Forget about it, yeah.
Just, you know, your classic looking at your family,
right,
and stuff. Because you can think that you keep things away from people,
yeah.
But of course you can't, because you're going to be hungover, or you know, even if you don't fall into movie traps, you can't. Basically, your character is shredded, and so it's mainly just that. Just thinking, holy crap, and also, you know, from pure selfish. Pure selfishness was thinking, I'm not being the best I can be at comedy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I'm just getting away with it. And I can't stand the thought of people who've not seeing me be actually good. Yeah. Like even people who thought I was good.
Yeah.
Thinking, oh no, I'm not being.
I'm better than that.
Yeah.
I can do better than that.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's a tough one because you've got a child. Have you got
two?
And it is a weird one, because again, a lot of people will have. And again, we're here now in sunny Essex, and it's a very Essex thing to, you know, I don't drink around my kids. I'll have a few drinks, but I don't get drunk around my kids.
Yeah.
And it's not that awareness that it's not just the drinking around the kids. It is, as you said, it's when you're hungover the next day. It's the variation in the care you're giving them, in the attention you're giving them.
Yeah, it's your tiredness.
Your bags under your oldest kind of thing, even as simple as it may seem. If you've been boozing the night before, you're going to be
a bit drunk,
smellier, a bit drunk, a bit, you know, you're not going to be this amazing father figure. Yeah. You're going to be this slowed down,
insecure,
weakened version of yourself.
Yeah, shuddery and damaged a little bit, and kind of, you know, fragile.
And kids are so aware and susceptible to all that. Yeah. They're so
then you seek aware. You seek out barbecues, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
You seek out do's.
Yeah,
you know, and you could tell the other parents too that seek out like birthday parties where there's going to be someone else on the wine.
Yeah,
and
have a few drinks.
And you find each other, don't you? And then you find any situation where you can do everything and have a drink.
Yeah,
and then when you pull back and you're sober, you think, oh, actually, this. Yeah. That's none of those times are very good for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how was it when you got, you said the first year was kind of
that was a bit horrible.
You didn't enjoy it.
Yeah, because I realized that, you know, my character was kind of frozen at 17. It's like rebuilding everything again.
Yeah.
You know, emotionally not very intelligent, or just loads of like. And also looking at yourself and go, God, what is it that you do? What do you have? Like, what are your interests even?
Yeah.
That was a big one.
Yeah, that's a mad one,
and
right?
Like all these things I thought I was interested in, I wasn't that interested in, and it turns out.
It's just they were places where alcohol was. You know?
So just discovering like, I guess I better get into something.
Yeah.
I like history, I think. Do I still like that? Yep. And I started following the NFL again, because the last time I was sober, like I was 15 or so, I was into the NFL.
Wow.
So that felt nice and safe.
Yeah.
So that first year was a bit bad.
It's fascinating, because there is, there's a big chunk of extra time to fill there. And if you don't fill it, they're the times it's going to be hardest
long
to not
days.
Go back to it, to create. Yeah, exactly. Because again, you forget about it's both, as we were just saying. You're writing off the evening to drink. And you're writing off a chunk of the morning to recovering from it anyway. So those days are actually a small window that you were previously having to fill with sober entertainment.
Yeah, life.
And now you've got this whole
period. Yeah, between about 2 and 6
Yeah.
Was all that you had to.
That's the living part.
And I remember coming off of... the first year was just for me. If I had maybe better... had I done proper therapy or something, or maybe something like that, a proper way about it. You know, I put on loads of weight, eating loads of ice cream because I was craving sugar in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
So, and because I guess a part of me thought I'd be like, within a month, I'd be just 100%. So it just was slower for me.
Yeah.
Building things up. Can't remember what I was going to say, but it was profound.
Do you think that's because you decided to do it just yourself? Without any help, without anything else, just go, right, I'm done now. All right.
Yeah, because my wife, I was in Edinburgh, my wife and the twins, they just said, you know, that was it. She took twins away because it was starting to encroach too much. They went back to London and I was left in this flat in Edinburgh and with my new dog.
Right, yeah.
You know, that was really, really dark. Yeah. Just me and a mattress and a big black German Shepherd who kept kind of going, dude, you know. Keep with it. Come on, buddy.
A black dog as well.
Yeah.
The ironic symbolism there. Of, I know,
right? That's exactly what I thought every day. There you are.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, my gig was on at 1 PM at the Stand, and I remember just getting enough vodka in me and enough gag to get enough confidence to get to the venue. And then when I was on stage for that hour, it was like blessed relief.
Yeah, yeah.
And then some people have seen that show go, oh, my God, that was great. But then other people are going, oh, no, it's too raw for me.
Yeah.
Because it was like, I remember a snapshot of the audience where they would watch with their heads sort of tilted to the sides. So they were laughing but concerned. Anyway.
I remember that.
I
remember experiencing that with Doug Stanhope, who's a wonderful one, but he's, you know, he wears his troubles on his sleeve. But I remember seeing him on the tour just after his mum had passed away, and it walked that painfully fine line between this is amazing and genius and a work of art, and are we watching an accident here? Well, are we roadside going, oh, look at this happening? Yeah. You know, he pulled it off and he was amazing.
Say we were there when.
Yeah, exactly. It felt like that. And he's one of my favourite comedians, and his crafting is amazing. So he got through it and it worked. But it was that. And I can imagine a similar thing if people are watching, some going, this is genius, and others going, this is too close to the edge.
And I didn't want to be that genius guy that was... But I was very lucky because my mother-in-law, who lives up in the Midlands, took me in.
Yeah.
And I went to the hospital, local hospital, every day on this sort of like, you know, very basic recovery program.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is, you know, free and all that. So I was very lucky to be in Britain.
Yeah.
To have family that would, you know, because ultimately I should have been homeless. But, and this is what, you know, to be so thankful for just having people who gave a shit.
Yeah.
And that's awesome. And then that took, you know, bought me 6 months time to, you know, slowly rebuild.
Yeah.
And become bionic. But then, now I get to these phases where I can't even, like, the thought of drinking or doing anything like that now repulses me because I'm so bitter at myself and it.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
That
yeah.
I actually am quite snooty towards that version of myself.
Yeah.
Like, oh, God, I wouldn't have. Like, I'm turned into a bit of a wanker towards myself.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Because the idea of that it guy. Is just such like, a nightmare. Oh, my God, what a waste.
Yeah.
What a bloody waste. You know? I mean, I don't have time for that.
Yeah, I love it.
Because I just skip along now. You know, you have your same downtime, but everything's different and everything's kind of interesting now. Because, so in a way, you know, I'm glad I was a bit of a moron for so long because like everything is so exciting.
It's a really powerful statement there that was kind of a bit a throwaway, and I don't mean to focus on it too much, but it is it must have been a real powerful thing to realize that in that situation, if you didn't have friends and family and you weren't in the UK, that you could genuinely have been towards homelessness.
Well, that's
right. That's a mind-blowing thing to think, because we see homeless people and we dehumanize them completely. We can't relate or connect, but you're someone who's in the public eye and has known, and people who didn't know the struggles you were going through would think his life's amazing. He's living the dream. I know of that famous comedian. And you could literally, you know, a couple more steps and you could have been homeless.
Yeah, because, like, you know,
terrifying.
Run out of money and, you know, and then, you know, the think of your family, all of that. Like, that's the bit, you just the guilt, you know.
Yeah.
It makes you, yeah. No, easily. Just that,
crazy,
like that.
Isn't it? Yeah.
But I had people around me and then, I had my family in Canada sort of, you know, help my mother-in-law to help me.
Yeah.
And or mainly to help my little family.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Some freaking, you know, spoiled. Like,
yeah.
You can't buy that kind of.
No.
So lucky as anything.
Or to have come so close to the edge in that way and to have seen what potentially could have been losing your family, losing all of this.
Oh, yeah.
To have people pull you back and help you and look after them and look after you. And then, that's got to be the biggest motivation possible, right?
Quite a funny thing to realize, though, is because you get sober and you think, God, I must have been so horrific and all that. But actually, sometimes you come to these realizations, you go, God, I'm actually still a bit of a prick. So there's so much more work you got to keep going.
Yeah.
God, I can be an asshole sometimes.
Yeah. To look and go, oh, that bit wasn't the booze. That was just me.
I'm just
shit.
I'm just a dickhead. Yeah.
I've had that with loads of stuff. I've never had an addiction, but I've tried a lot of different drugs over the years, and now I choose to not do any. And part of that is feeling like I got off lightly. I've got a lot of my mates who I did dead acid with or pills with or whatever else had bad experiences, and I never did. And I'm kind of that one to look and go, shit, this is the time to walk away before it ruins me. Before it pulls me apart. But it's exactly that. I had to come genuinely, and I joke about it with my friends and my girlfriend and my family and everyone all the time. I had to come to terms with the fact that I'm really boring. I'm quite a boring person. I'm not really into big fun events and gatherings, things like that. I like to watch my films and do my stuff. It's like, but that was a thing to come to terms with at first. You go, actually, on a night out, if I'm not hammered or on some kind of drugs, I'm going to be quite quiet in the corner and keeping myself to myself. You know?
With me, it was like rediscovering the things why, going way back to the drinking in the first place. It's like, oh, yeah, I find it hard to make eye contact with people in conversation. And I actually, you know, don't like going out ever. And I don't like, you know, and the only thing that stopped me from, you know, hanging out with people a lot was, not wanting them to be with me for longer than a half an hour.
Yeah.
Because then I thought, well, I'll just end up remembering, oh, I do have that thing where I blurt out stuff that's inappropriate.
Yeah.
And I do got some sort of a Tourette's going on.
Yeah.
And discovering all that again and going, oh, yeah, there was a reason why.
Yeah.
And then instead of just going, well, that's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay. You get in your car and talk to yourself all the way home.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
Again, it's realizing exactly that it's fine. It's completely acceptable. I've had
and
to...
kids like a person like that.
Yeah, completely.
Jibber jabbers on their own.
Yeah, that's the entertainment.
They think dad's eccentric. So thank goodness for those guys and their people.
Yeah, yeah.
The children community. They're just good people.
Yeah, they're good. So what's ahead? I mean, as we record this, you're doing your shows at the Underbelly. I think when this comes out, it'll be Fringe time. So
I've done Underbelly now.
You've done Underbelly now, yeah.
Yeah, and I did, instead of doing the old tour show, I did a brand new, I've been doing my brand new show, and that'll be at Edinburgh Fringe all August.
Yeah.
At 3 p.m. in the afternoon.
That's good.
What I like it. Yeah, stay away from anybody drinking.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Most people that like me, ironically, are pretty sober, nerdy, kind of curious people.
How does that kind of feel, kind of returning to the scene of the crime as such? Because Edinburgh is where it all fell apart, essentially, which is, but importantly, that's what saved you. If it hadn't fallen apart, you may have just coasted along in a bad place for a long time.
Well, the first year back was hard
in
Edinburgh. That was rubbish.
Yeah.
And then the next year, which is last year, Edinburgh was pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
And it was really good.
Yeah.
And the gigs got laughs the whole show.
Yeah.
And everyone came out the other end. And the shows were, they were a little bit too out there. Like I did a 45-minute I wanted to be more storytelling, but I ended up telling a long story about my 1970s career as a trampolinist, and I created this whole world of and all of it was done in an Alabama accent. Yeah. So not the best way to relaunch yourself in the the media world, but the fans liked
it's
it.
Totally relatable.
Yeah, and it was consolidated, you know? Yeah. And now this one is so it's just been a build, and now I'm really excited because I can now call myself an artist again. Like, you know, like I can feel that was the big switch, I think, is to go, yeah, you're not just a turn. I mean, you are. You're a turn and you're going to do some laughs like a clown.
Yeah, of course.
But if you tell yourself you're also an artist, then that can give you more confidence to be even a better turn.
Yeah. Can the Fringe make you put the spotlight on yourself more and analyze yourself? I'd imagine last year's doing a 45-minute story in an Alabama accent about this, but doing it every day has to make you go, right, where's the art in this, and what is the beauty in this, and which bits are escapism and which bits are a safety blanket of not being myself yet. I'm not ready to be myself here again yet.
Yeah,
I'll be someone else.
That's exactly it. I look back on that after. During the time, I was just telling myself how impressive I was.
Myself
going, oh, man, you're just riffing this. And
yeah.
Yeah, then looking back, just going, oh yeah, not ready to be yourself.
To be me here, yeah.
And also trying to build up your confidence by going, yeah, see, I can still paint like this.
Yeah.
I could paint like that,
yeah,
but I choose to paint like this.
Yeah.
That's kind of what that was.
Completely.
And now I want to do some painting that's just more accessible, but has a bit of that.
So what is the new show? Yeah,
it's called A Lost Show.
Yeah.
And I think it's about lost time and everything, obviously, you know.
Yeah.
it's about in my head, it's about all the lost shows that could have been really good.
Life
show. And it opens with the two lanterns on their own in the dark, and one of them's remember Marshall McLuhan, the Canadian philosopher guy. The medium is the message,
right?
Saying, and then the other one is trying to work out what that means. Are you saying that Tony show's going to... And it sort of explains what the show's going to be like, but by a 17-year-old lamp?
Yeah.
Is that what you... But all he can say is, the medium is the message. And then later on, and one of the themes that goes throughout it is, when I came over here, I never did learn to play any instruments, and I never did join a band, and that was
the original
remit.
Yeah.
And the reason was fear. I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah.
And if I did learn how to play the guitar, I'd play it badly. And so this fear, and I pushed it away and never even touched it. And I thought, so I'm going to purposely now, each show, teach myself how to play the guitar, but without any lessons and without, and I don't even call it a guitar to get past the fear. I haven't even got a name for it.
Yeah.
And they're called wires, not strings. And so everything has a different name. And then I slowly, because I got it on an open tuning, I slowly throughout the show keep picking it up and can play a little bit more.
Yeah.
And then at the end, I have this really earnest rock song that is, the song is, it's not about what the lamps, because the lamps chat throughout.
Yeah.
It's not about what the lamps are saying.
Yeah.
It's about the lamps.
Right.
So that's the McLuhan idea. It's about the light coming on. And so then the song is called It's About the Lamp.
Yeah.
It's about the lamp. And so I did this song, and then I got my talented musician friends to then put a whole bunch of layers on it.
Amazing.
And help me with my... that's one of the benefits of when I had that window back in 2014 or 13.
Right. Yeah.
Was doing gigs for the Teenage Cancer Trust. So I met some really talented, nice people.
Yeah.
Who really liked me and didn't necessarily see my fall, but still liked me from there. So that's great. And then I can say, so like my childhood here was Roger Daltrey growing up,
of course.
Or The Who. And so I became friends with his son-in-law.
Yep.
So he helps me with my songs.
Oh,
now.
Wow.
But one of the things that meant the world was he said, yeah, I told, because I'd done one of the gigs there and Roger thought it went really well.
Yeah.
And I'm friends with his son-in-law. Dez told him, I said, you know, Tony Law's got sober now. And he said, oh, that's brilliant. tell him well done or something like that.
Yeah.
And when he told me that, it was like, oh, wow, that's like some sort of full circle coming on. Like,
yeah,
if I could say that to my 15-year-old self, I could have avoided a whole bunch. So that was awesome. So anyway, he's the one who's helping me with the song.
I love that.
So there's a real kind of lovely connection.
Yeah, all of it feels like it's a show that could only happen now. And that sounds obvious because that's every show. But I mean, it feels like everything there, it's come full circle. It starts with your arrival in the UK, largely because you'd lost your license to drunk driving.
Then it
culminates now with Sober and Roger Daltrey and his son and all of this all coming together. It's a beautiful one. It all comes together in a journey.
Yeah, and then also if you don't see any of that,
yeah,
also running along it is just some really silly comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there's never even a moment of actual earnestness.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's all done with just high state. My character's low status, but pretends to be high status.
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of guy. He just kind of acts like he knows all the answers.
Yeah.
And his vulnerability is he doesn't see it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's just good observations. And
I love
jokes.
It.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds great. Well, thank you for coming along and giving me an hour of your time. It's flown by as ever. Where can people keep up to date on everything? Are you on Twitter?
Yeah, Twitter's the main one, I guess. And then there's a website, but I don't know how to do it. But they put my dates up on there.
Yeah.
Mr. Tony Law, I think. Not Tony Law Tools, that's the other one.
No one knows about websites anymore. It's so weird. I've got mine and I forget that there's stuff on there. And it's handy and it all keeps up to date. But Instagram? I swear it's just I'll tweet and Instagram stuff.
Yeah.
And
so Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Not Facebook so much, but Twitter for sure.
Yeah.
And then and that's basically it's just about like going straight to the show now. It's like I'll see you there, guys.
Yeah.
3 p.m. at the Monkey Barrel in Edinburgh every day.
Perfect.
Let's meet up. So,
let's do it. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Pleasure. And thanks for coming out to Essex.
Pleasure.
Perfect.
Thanks a lot, man.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Tony Law on the Distraction Pieces podcast. And I thought he was absolutely amazing. So honest and open. The bit I mentioned in the intro that really struck me was how close he came to being homeless. And I think this was such an important thing to talk about and address because we do kind of see homeless people and we just see them as homeless people. And we often don't take a moment to think of the journey that's led them there or how close anyone could be from being that person, from hitting that low. And to think of someone who I know off the TV and that and was genuinely, no exaggeration, close to being in that situation is absolutely heartbreaking. So, beautiful openness and humbleness, and I was delighted to talk to Tony. I'll be back next week, of course. I think I'm gonna go, so next week it's gonna be Professor Green, and I kept hyping the Chili Gonzalez episode as the best episode I've ever done, and then before the Chili one came out I recorded the Professor Green one, and it's a push for best show I've ever done. We talk about obviously rap and hip-hop and the music industry, but depression, suicide, dangerous dogs, that sounds like a weird combination of things, but it's a special one. And then after that I'll be putting out the example episode, and then we've got a special wrestling episode, and there's tons of good stuff to come. So keep tuning in. I'm also hoping to line up some apps. I've got a couple of guests that if they come through they're going to blow your mind. So excited about that. I will talk to you soon. Check out the other podcasts on the network, particularly the new ones. Films Will Be Buried with Brett Goldstein and Off the Beaten Track with Stu Whiffin. They're great. But also, obviously, still Hardcore Listing. I genuinely listen to that every week with great glee and excitement. It's a highlight of my week. Tuesday Night Jaws on a brief break, but that'll be back in a matter of weeks. Obviously, the Stop and Search podcast is every month. and Say Why to Drugs is there as a catalogue of education, and we'll do some more at some point. But yeah, check them all out. Other than that, I will see you next week. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.